Everyone has ambitions. For most of us, those ambitions are still on the to-do list. But some people overcame procrastination. They said screw it and just did it anyway. I, Alex Chisnell, meet inspirational entrepreneurs, leaders in human optimization, entertainers, authors who all took that leap. They had the vision, followed through with the action, and got from where they were to where they wanted to be. In this series of revealing, challenging, and often surprising conversations that inspire you to screw it and just do it and get from where you are to where you want to be. Now, on to today's show. Today, I've got the absolute pleasure of sitting with one of the three world champion Atherton siblings, Rachel, the most awarded British mountain biker in the history of the sport. About to be joined by former national champion Dan, her brother, plus here with Atherton Bike CEO Dan Brown. And the Athertons are probably best known for their influence within the downhill mountain biking space, but for anyone not familiar with the world of mountain biking, the Athertons are perhaps the most successful family mountain biking dynasty of all time. So we're going to talk about competing in downhill mountain biking. So kicking things off, tell me about the £10 BMX bike, I believe, that was originally bought.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask, how did you get into the sport and you know, how did you get to the top? But it does start from when you're a kid and you know, most kids probably grow up having a bit of fun on bikes, you know, skateboards, rollerblades, anything like that. You know, we grew up in a very rural area, so it was down in Devon. There wasn't much to do, you know, not the traditional kind of, you had to make your own fun, basically. Yeah. And Dan's the oldest, and we've got G, he's the middle brother, and myself as the youngest one. And it was very much a case of, yeah, just making your own entertainment. And Dan was, he was then, and he still is now, you know, very kind of, sort of creative, I suppose. Like, he was never happy as a kid. Like Mum always said, he was never happy just being, you know, in the garden. He wanted to build things and create things and make things for him and other kids to do. So he very quickly started building just bike tracks on this little bit of scrubland. And it kind of became an area where us and all the kids in the village just kind of congregated and had this space to kind of, yeah, grow up in, really. And it was, for us, it was bikes, and he was kind of the driving force for us to get into cycling and for most of the kind of kids in the area. And he still has that kind of leadership quality about him. People just seem to follow him, and he creates, yeah, places for people to express themselves.
And back then, specifically, what else did you enjoy? What else were you good at? What did you just do? Was it all based around bikes?
Yeah, I mean, I was very young, like Dan. It's mad to think back on it. Like Dan just used sort of, I guess magazines back then were the big thing. You didn't have social media as such, so he very quickly discovered like the BMX kind of world, and then it quickly escalated into racing. And I suppose Dan was always like, how can I take this further? Like, what can I do? I want to do more jumps, bigger jumps. And so he discovered racing quite quickly, and G and Dan got into racing BMX around the southwest, that kind of area, like around Exeter, Burnham. Mm. You know, there's a lot of BMX tracks around there, and now it's an Olympic sport, but back then it wasn't. But it's so accessible, BMX. You know, you don't have to drive to the top of a mountain. You don't have to have really any specialist equipment. We just rode bikes, you know, you found in the skip, like just anything you could get your hands on, really. And then me being the youngest, I just didn't want to be left behind. So I just did what my brothers did, just because I didn't want to be left out. Yeah. And Dan was always the one with the vision. You know, he was always like, you know, Rach, start racing. G, start doing this. And yeah, he's kind of been the driving force our whole lives, really.
Interesting.
Pretty incredible.
And I remember that neck of the woods. That's how I got into bikes, was BMX racing. I remember getting a shiny new bike.
Yeah, when you were a kid, like, it's about bikes and, you know, having a place. Like, that's why it's so important, whether it's pump tracks now are very kind of, that's the new thing, a specific area in town, villages. And it's so important for kids to have these areas where they are kind of left to do their own thing, and they can explore these different avenues and different interests and passions. And
it was
Dan kind of, was the driving force. And I think he's always had that sort of vision bigger than where he is. It's always been about what's next. Like, he's always wanted to go bigger. And it's testament now that place, over 30 years later, that area where we grew up riding, where Dan started building those first bike tracks, is still there. It's still on the outskirts of the village. It's still really popular. The whole southwest area still rides there, and that kind of speaks volumes, really, about the sort of legacy that he creates wherever he goes, really.
That's awesome. And I'm going to talk about legacy later on, interestingly enough. But you mentioned vision. Was Dan the one with the overall vision? And was that all around biking to start with, or was there another vision to start with?
Yeah, I think when you're a kid, it's all mainly about having fun, you know? Like, yeah, it, for him and G, it was about, you know, the next fun thing is big jumps and then bigger jumps. And it was sort of always about, yeah, just enjoying yourself on bikes. And when they started racing, we started racing BMX, and I started racing BMX when I was about 8. So Dan must have been like sort of 10, 11 sort of age. And it very quickly, that competition like eats you up, and it just is so exciting. You know, we used to travel around to the races with Dad in the caravan, and we'd go off all weekend, and it was just such a cool lifestyle, you know, going all weekend to ride your bikes and compete with your friends that you've built up in that sort of race scene. And I think growing up in competition, it's very quickly develops a sort of passion for pushing yourself, you know. It's not all about race results. And I think a lot of kids now are like, with social media, like, how do I get sponsored? How do I get more followers? And how do I get seen? But back then it was just, you know, for the joy of pushing yourself and for the joy of, yeah, bettering yourself and bettering your skills and ultimately having more fun. And it wasn't until a lot later where we sort of thought, you know, could this be a career? Is there something in this? And even then it was a very like organic progression into making it a career. You know, it was just following your passion, I suppose, from an early age.
As kids then, who or what inspired you at that time? Because as you say, it wasn't as accessible to flip your phone on and follow somebody on Instagram or look at a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But it was a different way of finding out.
Yeah, I think magazines were very, very important, you know, back then, by the time we started racing. And then, you know, I say you're often a product of your environment as a kid. So we started racing BMX, and, you know, my dad lived in Exeter, and there was a BMX track, great facility there. And so that's what we did. And then we moved house up to Somerset, and there was more woodland and more mountains around. So then we started riding mountain bikes, and we very quickly started racing the mountain bikes. And it was all about the magazines, really. You'd get the magazine and you'd pore over it for the next month and seeing and I think in the UK there was a lot of successful mountain bikers at that time.
Yeah.
There was like Steve Pete and Tracy Mosley, people that were winning international races. And I think that's really important to give you, to kind of make you believe that it's possible. And we were very lucky to have those role models when we were younger, growing up. And that was kind of, that was it, really. Once you discover that competition and that race side, it really takes hold of you. And the British scene in mountain biking is amazing. It's massive, you know. If it was if downhill mountain biking was an Olympic sport, if it was, you know, cross country road ride, these would be household names. You know, we've got world champion after world champion every year, World Cup winners, loads of them. And then the Olympic, you know, disciplines really struggle. And mountain biking, it's just so, it's so good in the UK. And that's probably a testament to, the magazines, the kind of, and the race scene, you know, giving these kids and giving people access to it, really. Yeah, it's all about access and pushing that limit.
And I remember when BMX came into the Olympics. Is that something that your sport's pushing?
BMX changed very quickly as soon as it went into the Olympics. It becomes more about the performance and the kind of, not, I wouldn't say the athletic side, because, you know, mountain bike, we train really hard, but it's easily controlled, and it loses that kind of element of what created it in the first place, really. Mountain biking and downhill is such a cool sport, because it is an elite, you know, a professional sport, but it's also, you can mix with the professionals, and, you know, you go to a race, and it's all very humble, really, and the kids can chat to the pro riders, and I think that's so inspiring, you know, and probably one of the reasons why, the Brits are so good at it, yeah.
It'd be good to know as well, like for you, at what point did you realise then, like, how old were you, where were you when you thought, this could be a career, and what other options were there?
I just remember basically doing what Dan told me to do. You know, he was like, you can race. So I was okay, I'll do that. And then he was like, you can be good at this. You can win races. Like, you could be World Cup. You could win World Cups. And I was like, okay.
Right.
I just trusted him so much, and I looked up to him. You know, he was. You know, I'm not going to say a father figure to G and I, but, you know, when your parents separate and they split up, like, Dad was always there for us 100%, but Dan was just such a... He just believed in G and I before we even realised what there was to believe in, you know. And I think having that unconditional belief, whether it's from a parent or a sibling or a coach or anyone in the life of a young athlete is... You know, like I didn't even know you could make a career out of downhill mountain biking, and Dan was... You know, he was already racing World Cups, and he was thinking, you know, these two could be good at this. Like, he just saw it and believed in it, and I kind of just went with it. I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't for him, 100%. And I've said it before, you know, I owe all my success and my career to Dan, definitely. Yeah.
This is a very good moment to bring Dan in.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
How are you doing?
Wow.
Nice to meet you.
How are
it's
you?
Been an interesting morning.
Yeah. Very interesting, as always.
You heard that part of the conversation, Dan.
Yeah.
And we're talking about where the vision came from, not only from the racing side of things, but let's bring Dan Brown in very soon as well to talk about Atherton bikes. But for you, what was that vision to start with, and when did you first start actually encapsulating something that bears some resemblance to what you've got today?
I think we were lucky enough to have like good mentors in, you know, parents and grandparents, and from a very early age we didn't really look at it as a short term, you know, something we were kind of doing as a pastime. We kind of thought about it as a way of life, and it's always been a way of life. And so we were always kind of keen to put back into what we were doing, you know, invest in what we were doing. So, you know, with Brownie coming along, that was the first kind of step on that path to building a solid team and a solid crew around us that we could kind of take with us.
And when you kind of cast your mind back, was there a specific moment that you thought, this is what I want to do? Can you pinpoint any moments that you thought, this is all I want to do?
Yeah, I think I've always felt really blessed to have that direction and kind of passion for mountain biking and cycling in general, you know. And you know, it gives you like a direction, and it gives you so much focus in life. That it's, you know, if you have something like that, it's almost, I feel like life's a little bit easier because you just channel everything into it, and
you're not questioning where am I going
next.
Yeah,
it takes you along for the ride almost.
Yeah,
pretty incredible, really. Yeah, like you've always created things, like you want to create this place in Kurzweil to ride, and then it's the next place, and you've always kind of been a leader for people that are a bit lost almost, or like that have this passion, but you focused on and like you know where you wanted to go from such an early age.
Are you the type of people who have like a plan, a structure, or is it being kind of more organic?
No, it's very, very structured, yeah.
No, it's not. It's totally not. So, I feel like,
Dan's, Brownie's making the comments down there. Yeah. Would you like to allude to anything else?
Well, I think there's a key moment in the whole kind of history and timeline is Red Bull paid for these guys to start working with Jamie Edwards is his name. In 2008, he came on board, and he basically walked into what was their house in Mid Wales at the time, and just looked around, shaking his head, and just said, "This isn't how world champions live." And it was, you know, it was quite a. I came in 2006. We'd done quite a lot, progressed through 2007, and then Jamie came in 2008 and kind of. That was a big step change then, really, and just got us to look at what we were doing and how we were doing it. And that was a big kind of catalyst, really, for making things more professional and bringing some structure to what was chaos.
Yeah.
And where did you find him?
Yeah, he worked with Red Bull athletes. Yeah. He worked with cricketers like Freddie Flintoff.
Okay.
Yeah, he'd been kind of always there. And
it's not like we had a plan saying, like, you know, we're going to race for 10 years. I feel like other athletes and other people are very, like you say, structured, and they're like, right, I'm going to do this for 10 years, then I'm going to start a bike brand, then we're going to do this. It's always been quite organic and like quite a natural progression, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen in life and how you're going to feel and what your interests are going to be in 5 years, you know. But it's about really listening to, like Dan always says, like, what makes you get up in the morning? Like, why do you want to get out of bed and push? Whatever the reason is, that's what you've got to find, you know? So that it's, you're getting up excited, you want to get out of bed and you want to do it. And for me, that was racing. And for Dan, you know, it was racing for a bit. And then he was pretty done after the injuries he had. And it was creating this sort of center of excellence. And it's always been about, you know, really listening to that voice inside and giving it a voice, because if you're not honest with yourself, it's not going to last very long, you know. Yeah. It's not going to, if you're pushing against the grain, you're not going to, whatever it is you're trying to do, it's just not going to happen unless you really love it and you believe in it.
And at what age then did you all start, like, competing with downhill racing, you being the first, I guess?
Yeah, I started when I was 16. G was like 13 or 14, and Rach would come along to races but not ride too much in between, and then she started winning and she was kind of addicted to winning, but we were like, Rach, if you're gonna do this properly, you need to ride your bike as well as just win. And but she, I don't know, she was just, you know, just always so good at racing. Just from the first race she did, she was able to find like another place in her head that she went to, that she could, you know, it was like a switch that she could turn, and that was always there, you know. It's always been in her, and it's pretty inspiring to watch, you know.
Yeah, but you and G were good straight away, because you loved it, you know. After, you would do your homework at school in lunchtime, so that they could just, as soon as the school finished, they could just ride the bikes, and you know, their skill level was so much higher than the other riders in the UK, and then internationally when they went abroad, because they just lived it, you know. They just, and I didn't really like riding. I just like competing, like Dan said. But they just loved riding, and that the skills you develop in those, like, you can't rush that. Just hour after hour after hour of, you know, the 10,000 hour rule. Like, they were just living that passion all the time, and that goes a long way in you know, being good at something, whatever it is.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that then, both of you as well. That's interesting. Like the 10,000 hour rule as well, when it comes to helping you get from where you were to where you are now, and talking about, like, the, not the sports psychologist, but is it Jamie who came in, how did that help you? Talk to me a little bit about, like, training, about, like, role models, the hours that you put in for training.
I think people do underestimate just how much time you do need to spend doing, you know, your chosen sport, and I think that's where the consistency comes from. And, you know, in a sport like mountain biking, where you've got so many variables, so many different tracks, different weather conditions, you know, you have to be on the bike a lot to hit all of those different conditions. And so, yeah, you know, we would just do two or three sessions a day every day, you know, unless it was a rest day. And you just kind of get into that. You just get into that mindset. And I've always thought, like, the better you get at something, the more you love it. And it's like a snowball effect, you know. You just get better, and then you ride more. And
more enjoyable.
Yeah, it just feeds into it, you know.
But that's why you've always said, like, you've got to love it. You've got to love it. Because to put that amount of work and dedication and through the hard times as well, if you don't love something, you're just not going to do it. Like, you're just going to take the easy option as soon as it comes around.
Well, it was like Charlie last weekend, wasn't it? We signed Charlie 5 years ago, and it's taken 5 years for him to win a major event with us, and we've always known he was capable of it.
Yeah.
And obviously he's always known it.
But you've just got to keep,
the right conditions,
keep
going on. The right
keep
day.
Plugging away. And that's because he loves it. He's not going to just...
Yeah, you'd do it anyway, even if you weren't winning, you know? You're not doing it to win, but...
And I think that's, like, interesting nowadays, where there's, like, social media and everyone's trying to like live the dream a bit more, like what can I do, can I start this, should I do a coffee shop, like what can I do, you've got to still love it, you know, whether it's, you know, quitting your job in the city to become a carpenter, like you've got to have that passion for it. Otherwise, you just don't follow it through when it's when the hard times come, and that's, you know, they do come round, and you've got a. That's why I think you know we've had so many injuries between us, in the you know all three of us, G as well, and you think, oh, this is ridiculous. I'm never going to ride again. And as soon as you get back on the bike, you're like, this is so fun, like yay! And then you're doing it again, and it's just ridiculous. Most people will break their neck, and then that'll be it. They probably never ride a bike again. Dan had a year off, and then he's straight back on it.
Was it? I was going to say, yeah, talk to me about setbacks and what it's like to literally get back in the saddle then, because you've all had your injuries. Maybe start with you, Dan, and setbacks and how you literally, you know, get back up and keep going.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the body's amazing at forgetting and moving on. You know, I crashed and broke my neck, C1, and I was super lucky, you know, didn't have any sensation of, you know, no numbness, no nothing paralyzed. It was a long road to recovery and really painful. You know, I was making videos at night on my phone saying, you know, don't ever put yourself back in this position, because it was just unbearable. But yeah, time moves on, delete the videos and get back on the bike, and yeah, it's amazing how the body can deal with it. But you know, every top athlete will have those stories, and you know, it makes you into a more consistent rider, into a more consistent athlete, and kind of gives you the knowledge that you need to win.
But it also crosses over to business as well, doesn't it? Because like that resilience that you build up, like, for sure has come in useful time and time again.
Yeah, just plugging away, you know. It's not about necessarily that day, it's about the long term or the bigger picture, really. Yeah. You know, when you're injured, it's very much keep that bigger picture in mind, like a year's time, 2 years' time, you know.
Mm. I was going to say, is that like the purpose as well for each of you, like having that purpose in mind? So you've gotten injured, you want to come back, but when you are coming back, it's tough. There are setbacks along the journey to recovery as well.
Yeah, and I think you need to have a really kind of reactive mindset and to be adaptable. I guess I've heard that a lot, you know, to be successful and stay at the top, you do need to be adaptable. And like Dan said, when you're injured, it does teach you a lot. It teaches you a lot about the sort of resilience. And I would say to myself, like, what can I do today that's going to help me get to there? You know, and if all you can do today is manage to get back on your feet and walk to the fridge, you know, that it's about those little goals and being happy with that process, I suppose. Yeah. Like, that's a big thing on social, isn't it? Like, trust the process. Yeah. But it's really true, you know, you need to be able to put your 100% focus into that little day, into that bit, because those accumulated, like, ticks off the goals are going to get you to where you want to be, you know, ultimately. And whether that's through an injury or through your career or through business, it's all about what you can do in that moment to succeed, I suppose, or, you know, to get further along that path.
So tell me a little bit about, so Dan was saying, like, you know, how much you were winning. Do you still have that mindset? Do you feel like you're in the zone, or whatever phrase you'd use? Do you recognise that when you're getting into that zone and you just have that single-minded mindset that you're going to win?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've always taken probably a bit of a different approach, like to winning, and you know, to my career, or just kind of what I've learned organically, really. Like, I don't really believe in a positive mental attitude. I believe, like, the worse you're thinking, the better you'll do.
Really.
And I think but that kind of relates back to, like, you know, those injuries, and like, I feel like for me, the bigger the obstacle to overcome, like the more problems, the more things have gone wrong, the more focused in you get, the harder you try, and the more experience you, more of your A game you bring. I feel like when you're confident, it's all going well, you're kind of a bit blasé, like, yeah, you know, I've got this. Whereas when things are going a bit pear-shaped and things are maybe a bit more difficult. You've maybe got an injury, you know, the weather's bad, or things you have to focus in on. You don't leave anything to chance. And I feel like, for me, that's the best way to perform, you know, when things are going a bit, yeah, the things are difficult, you really bring everything you've got to the table. And I think I've learned that that's, for me, the best way to get a performance out of myself.
You are pretty unique, though.
Things go wrong.
Yeah. That is, like, from working with probably 10, 12 athletes in the last 15 years, you're the only one that takes that approach.
Really?
Yeah, I've never seen Rach confident and... You know, on her A game, the morning
it's the
of
crux,
race.
Isn't it?
Really?
It's the crux that she needs.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, but if you're sat in your office, like, you know, orders for bikes rolling in, like, too many, like, oh, got this, like, everything's going well, don't need to... Whereas if you're like, right, I haven't got any orders, like, we need to... Come on, team, like, what can we do to get this better? And I think that's the attitude you need all the time, like...
You think that's just pressure, then, that you put... And you put that pressure on yourself.
It's definitely a way of you dealing with the pressure.
Yeah.
It's 100%.
Yeah. And the injuries are the same, because my career's just gone like that. You're like, I've won year after year, I'm winning. Then I get an injury and I'm out for the year, and then the next year I'm back winning. Because you've gone to the rock bottom, you know, you've gone low, and you have to bring everything to get back on it.
Was that like last weekend? Didn't you like dislocate your shoulder?
No, that didn't work last weekend. I thought it was going to be,
It was pretty inspiring, the fact that you actually rode though, like, you know, you did nothing the whole weekend, and then you were able to flip that switch that morning off and somehow get down.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. I mean, I've dislocated my shoulders a lot and had surgeries, blah, blah, blah. And the World Championships were in Scotland last week, and Home World Cup, we've been Home World Champs, you know, I've been thinking about it for years and training hard, and I hurt my shoulder, like dislocated it out and popped it back in myself, and then missed 2 days practice and somehow managed to find, like, G was saying, you'd be fine, Rach, you'd be fine to ride. And I was saying, I'm out of this competition, and somehow managed to get it taped up and I did the race. And it's just like Dan said, like switching that thing on in your head where you want to do it. You know, you're passionate. You're sort of willing to take the risk. Is it? You know, are the risks worth it? It's always a balance and trying to figure out how much to push and how much to put into how much of yourself to put into whether it's a sport or business or whatever it is.
And coming back from. What, nearly 4 years out as well, having, you know, COVID, giving birth to your daughter, and then coming back and winning.
Yeah, I mean, I had, it's been an up and down career, really, but I was winning 2019, still winning World Cups on our own bike. So we launched Atherton Bikes into 2019 and start of 2019. And I was thinking of retiring, and I was thinking, right, I can't retire. I want to race World Cups on our own bikes. You know, Dan's had this vision for years to do our own bike company. And then suddenly here we were, like we had the team, it was all kind of perfect. And I came that year and I won 2 World Cups on our own bikes. And that was just ridiculous to win a World Cup on our own bike was just, but to win 2, and then I snapped my Achilles tendon halfway through the year and that put me out, and it was just, that's just the way it goes, you know, up and down. And then had my daughter in 2021 and kind of thought about coming back to racing, and then I did the first one this year and I managed to win it somehow, so I won the first World Cup, and that was just ridiculous. Yeah, it was just such a huge surprise, and I guess a testament to, like we said, it, actually enjoying the process of what you do, like day to day. I loved the training. It took me a few years to find that motivation again, but I couldn't train without a goal of racing. You know, I couldn't, everyone was saying, just get in the gym for yourself. Like, you just get fit and strong, you know? But I was thinking, I need something to drive me. You know, people sign up for Ironmans and triathlons to give them that motivation. And for me, I need something huge as a reason, you know? Just to be fit and strong, it's not a big enough reason. No. You know, when you have such high highs, you need such big things to motivate you. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to the World Cups. And I was thinking, oh my God, I've now got to put the effort in. And without those goals, it's really hard to get the most out of yourself when you're already successful, because, you know, you do lose motivation. What's the point? Mm-hmm. You've been successful. You could just kick back at home and enjoy it. But giving yourself goals, and I feel like that's why we've always pushed quite hard in business and starting all these different things, because it gives you a reason, you know, it gives you a reason to keep pushing and to keep bettering yourself and to keep, yeah, to keep like pushing the bar and yeah, to keep bettering yourself, and whether that's to kind of give something back to the sport or yeah.
And then it leads us nicely into Atherton Bikes. And before yeah. I do, something you mentioned there, you know, having had your daughter and, you know, having a reason to get out of bed and do this, for you, did your purpose change as to why you get out of bed in the morning and why you do what you do?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, having a child is huge, and, you know, I've always wanted a family, but there's never a right time as an athlete. You never think, okay, now's the perfect time, like I'm going to either retire or still, I wanted to do both, and it doesn't, maybe it's a lot harder to do both, but it maybe doesn't have to be. I didn't want it to be like such a huge negative thing, you know. You lose sponsors, like everyone's like, oh, you've retired because you're having a kid. Like, why can't you do both? You know, it is hard, but it is also possible. And winning that first World Cup as a mother, which has never been done in our sport before, it just kind of, you know, it's not easy at all. But you don't have to maybe choose. Like, you can... Yeah. Put in the hard work, and you can maybe have a good balance of life and a career. And as a woman, it's definitely a lot harder, but it's doable. And yeah.
Did you have role models? And you think of like a sport like tennis, is like Serena Williams, like a massive role model. But in your sport, you said no.
Yeah, it was definitely hard to find, you know, to find those women that were kind of doing it. And I was very. Yeah, anxious and had no idea, like you say, what's your purpose? Mm. I didn't know if I was going to retire or if that would be the end or if I was going to return. And I still don't really. I'm really just taking it kind of race by race and month by month. And it's a real challenge to kind of be honest, like, with what you want, because you want both, you know. Yeah. You want to be at home with your kid and you don't want to miss anything, but you also want your career still, and you want that kind of purpose. And it's really hard to go from that kind of focused lifestyle to suddenly having no focus apart from raising a child.
Like, and the structure goes out the window,
yeah,
of course, because
yeah.
You've got to be flexible.
Yeah.
In a
small child. Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's been a huge learning curve, and it's definitely helped seeing other athletes. Not so much in our sport, but like you say, other more mainstream sports. We have got businesses, and it's still hard. You know, I've basically had 4 years of retirement since I snapped my Achilles to now, and it's been pretty, yeah, it's a shock to the system, because your expertise are in these areas. You know, I'm good at racing, I'm good at competing, I'm good at training. You know, I'm not good at the business side of it. I'm not really good at anything. You know, it's really hard to transfer those skills over. And Dan's always said, like, people, you do what you're good at and you get other people to do what they're good at.
But brings us to a good point, like, being Brownie more into the conversation. Let's talk about Atherton Bikes. But when did you guys all first meet, and when did you become part of the business?
Well, we met probably, I don't know, 2005, something like that. I joined them in 2006. And yeah, we raced for what, 15 years on the World Cup circuit.
Wow,
it's a long time.
Yeah.
Before thinking about next steps, and yeah, over that period of time, we talked about starting bike companies, doing something with the Afton name, which ultimately we kind of managed to build up quite a good following of over that period of time.
It's always been something, isn't there? Like, we want to do something with, like, say, this thing we've built. But what? What is that?
And Dan would always be sketching on pieces of paper for bike designs, and as we drove around Europe and in the back of sprinters and stuff. So there's always kind of seeds of ideas kicking around. But yeah, kind of the bike company came about at an opportune moment, really, where we were coming to the end of a sponsorship contract with a global brand. And there was an opportunity to join forces with a group of designers, engineers who had got a pretty cool idea behind the product, where they were printing, 3D printing metal to make the complex areas on the bike which deal with the loads, and then joining them together with carbon fibre, which also allows you to make some really good fitting bikes, because you could make them ultimately in any size you wanted. So tying in our kind of expertise from developing bikes for other brands, which we had done for those 15 years. We designed bikes with a number of different brands, using that expertise and bringing it in this kind of concept in from the designers and engineers was a really good combination. And then add the Afton brand into the mix, and it just seemed to make sense. Mm. A huge risk. Huge risk, and still is to this day.
And is that because that you shifted the model?
I mean, we basically took out the main sponsor of the race team, the comfort blanket that brings, and brought in the complete unknown of starting a new business.
Yeah, we were riding for Trek at the time, you know, that's the biggest brand in the world, and to suddenly start your own bike company, they all thought we were mad.
Yeah. Was it a conversation, a series of conversations?
Yeah, no, I mean, the path was laid out. We could have continued as we were, for sure, but it was always about, and it always has been about, pushing boundaries. You know, we started an event with Red Bull up in not too far from here, the Red Bull Hardline, and that was about pushing downhill racing that little bit further, just pushing those boundaries and you know, it's what Dan, G and Rach have always been about, is doing things a little bit differently. And this just felt right then to continue that through, to continue the legacy on of the Afton brand, but also to keep pushing those boundaries.
Mm. And tell me a little bit about the development process then of what we should call the world's fastest downhill bike.
Oh yeah, it is now.
We can take that one. And the second fastest downhill bike in the world as well.
Yeah, I mean, well, we were lucky to work with a suspension engineer called Dave Weagle, who's well known within the sport. We've known Dave probably since the start of racing, really. So we got a bit of a relationship with him, and that helped us work together in designing a suspension kinematic, which is kind of how the bike responds to bumps, hits, and turns. And then kind of tying that together with the engineering and the work that had gone into the kind of concept behind the product, and then ultimately designing it for the first kind of 18 months, racing it on the World Cup circuit. Rach, you know, won 2 World Cups on a very prototype product, one that was changing from one race to the next. It was ridiculous. It was hard to keep up with, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
I think it was the fact that because we were 3D printing it, we weren't stuck to the concept of a mold. Mm. We could make changes, and so the temptation was always there every race to make changes.
Right.
And it's ended up with a very refined product now, but you know, at the time, for those first 2 years, it was a nightmare for the guys here. You know, every race just changing. And, you know, it's given us an amazing product now.
And what was the goal at the very outset? Was it to build the world's fastest downhill bike, or was it to ultimately see other people riding those bikes on the streets of where you live? Or?
Well, you know, we come from racing, and that's all we've ever done. So, of course, the goal was to make the fastest bike. You know, whether that was kind of what we set out to do or not, but, you know...
Yeah, so there was kind of two halves, wasn't there? There's the performance side, which is obviously very important to us. And then, like Dan said, building the bikes that we would want to ride growing up as kids and like you say, just at the bike parks, everyday trails. And it started with the performance, and because that's the high end, and then we're sort of filtering it down and hopefully bringing more bikes in at more of an affordable price, I suppose.
I think Brownie said, you know, we'd always ridden for other bike companies, and so the process of refining a product until it's at its very best was so ingrained in what we did in the off season that, you know, we very much worked with the engineers here and refined until we were super happy with the product. And I think that will always happen, you know.
We wanted to create something like Dan said, like we've always done, you know, we've always tried to do things differently and better. You know, we were one of the first teams to do this kind of web series following behind the scenes of how it is to be an athlete on the World Cup scene, and now everyone's doing it. You know, it's all about sort of finding those things that aren't been done yet and doing those, because that's what interests us, I suppose, and doing it in a different way. You know, it's so exciting, rather than just doing the run of the mill the same as everyone else is doing. It's exciting doing things differently. Terrifying and risky.
And who did you look for inspiration when it comes to the business side of things? What companies or individuals were you looking at that you thought, Was there a blueprint out there that you could follow?
No, I don't think there was. I think in terms of the manufacturing process we have, it's very young. It's very additive manufacturing has been around for a good number of years, but historically mainly used for prototyping in small numbers. Mm. And we're kind of at the cusp of it, really, in terms of it moving into a mass manufacturing
In the cycling industry,
process,
really.
Yeah.
You know, like the engineers, you know, the guys on the team have worked. They've come from aerospace and F1,
right,
where that process, the manufacturing, 3D printing, it is used in those sport, in those sort of areas, but within cycling. And it's been so interesting the last year we've seen Specialized and other big brands have started prototyping in the same way that we are, because they've realized like how reactive it can be, and it's helping them speed up their design process. Mm. So it's kind of cool to see a global brand like that kind of copying us, basically.
And how do you grow and scale the business?
There's a kind of a general concept behind the product is a lug and tube construction, which is very different to.
Do we have an example?
Yeah, for those watching, which basically you deal with all of the complex loads through the material, the titanium material on this product.
Okay, so this is the 3D printed bit.
And then the tubes are conventional uniformed shape, which basically are very lightweight.
Yeah,
these are the
carbon
tubes. There's less load going through that product. So, like I said before, what it ultimately allows you to do is have, because we've got a toolless process for this product, so there's no commitment to molds, we can just use different digital files to create these parts really quickly. So we have lots of different sizes. We can put the material exactly where we want it. And that basically gives you a very strong product. And that concept moving forward, lug and tube, is basically how we're going to scale the business. We have a prototype right now that's nearing production that allows us to scale in the thousands rather than the hundreds. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to bring that to market hopefully in the next month or two.
And when it comes to something like this at scale, it's going to cost you more money, so you go out to the market and raise funds.
Yeah, no, we're in a position now. We're in this building. We've outgrown it, and off the back of the weekend, off the back of the weekend, we're definitely going to be bursting at the seams because sales are flying in. Off the back of Rach's result, Andy also won his first World Cup. Who's our Austrian rider? He also won his home World Cup, which was amazing scenes as well. Mm. So we've had Rach win her first World Cup back, Andy win his first World Cup, and Charlie win his world title.
Yeah, that's what you mean by months. The weekend. The World Championships was the World Championships of down and mountain biking was up in Scotland in Fort William, and our British elite rider Charlie Hatton, who's from Forest of Dean originally, and he won the race, which is a massive deal. He became world champion on British soil on a British made bike, which is actually massive, and we haven't really talked about it yet, but it's, you know, to win on a British bike in Britain, it's huge. And like Dan said, our other elite rider Andreas Kolb won in Austria, and it's so cool, isn't it, seeing the proof there. Like, we know they're good bikes, we know that this is like the future, and to see the race results come in so quickly after we launch in 4 years, we've got world champion, we've won 4 or 5 World Cups. It's massive, and it's a real kind of boost for the team.
And it must be a marketer's dream having an Atherton winning on an Atherton built bike.
Yeah.
Well, I think the bigger milestone was having a non-Atherton winning on an Atherton
built bike. Yeah, that's right.
It's more powerful, isn't it?
You know, when Atherton bikes becomes bigger than Atherton athletes, individuals, is when we know we're making progress.
And that's where your dream it gets to, really. It's Atherton is the name of the bike in its own right. That's the company, and our family name and our career is in the past, you know, and the brand stands alone, and that's the goal, really, isn't it? And to have that first win on it is just incredible.
And what are your different roles in the business?
We haven't even talked about the bike park, have we?
Yeah, that's true.
No. Where you've just come from?
Where Dan's just come from. Yeah, no, so we bought Forest in 2019, similar time to starting the bike company. So we've had two startups running side by side, along with the race team.
So two massive startups as well.
It's been a crazy 4 years, but that's Dan's baby, really. That's where he creates the best riding in the UK and arguably some of the best tracks on the planet now. And it's exciting to see that grow.
And that's your passion?
Yeah, I think, well, it was kind of, we knew there was a process there, and so we thought, you know, it would be amazing to first of all have a bike park where we could, you know, test these bikes and bring people in and kind of build a scene around a bike company. But then earlier again than that, you know, to have an event like Red Bull Hardline that kind of puts the area on the map, you know. So whilst we were talking about structure in business before, you know, it's, there was like this loose kind of idea of, you know, we've built this name of Atherton, and then, you know, we're going to have this event, Hardline, and build a scene, kind of build an area, build a name for the area, and then start a bike park that's going to bring people in, going to bring people to the area. People are going to buy into the name, and then we're going to start a bike company. And, you know, ultimately, the bike company is kind of the main vision for the whole lot. You know, that's what everything feeds back to, you know, that name on that bike is where we want people to go ultimately.
But the bike park's sick, you know, like seeing people, you know, we get about 150 odd people a day, 4 or 5 days a week, and normally it's Whistler or, you know, Morzine in France, and suddenly there's this place in the UK that's a dream. It's a dream mountain bike escape, and a massive mountain, a forest, and there's tracks everywhere, and they just have the run of the place. You know, you get in the Land Rover and it takes you to the top and you ride back down, and it's amazing to be able to just be there and see people enjoying it and see people just loving it and give them... Dan's always been like this kind of... He's wanted a more clear way to the top of the sport, like other sports, you know, football, mainstream sports. There's a lot of a clearer path to get to be a professional, and mountain biking, it's kind of very much like up to, you know, a bit of luck and a bit of like how much time your parents can put in and to get you to there. And now there's more bike parks coming out. It's kids can come here and they can ride amazing tracks and progress. And we see races, we see all the World Cup races, the UK guys and now more international guys come in to train here, and then they go and win World Cups and they come back here to train. And it's just so cool to be able to offer that kind of facility here in the UK. It's definitely the dream.
And is that part of that wanting to give something, putting something back into the sport, and as part of that wanting to leave something behind as like a legacy piece?
Yeah, I think it's kind of building and creating what we would have liked to have had when we were growing up. You know, we went out and built dirt jumps and downhill tracks and kind of built what we wanted to ride, and so, but we were lucky, we lived in a place where you could do that. Not everyone has that. So I think starting the bike park was partly about giving back to the mountain bike scene that's kind of brought us up and given us such direction in life, and partly helping with the younger generation coming through, and hopefully that younger generation getting them on the brand, getting them on the Atherton bikes, and kind of creating that household name that they'll kind of stick with.
Yeah, nice. And along your journey from where you all were to where you wanted to get to, what moments would you say were just screw it and just do it anyway?
Yeah, definitely.
The forest purchase.
Definitely, that's true. I forgot about that. Yeah, buying the mountain and the forest.
Yeah, that's a big, big commitment.
There's been so many times when Dan's like phoned us up, guys, got to decide in the next hour. This is a massive opportunity. Like, this hotel's come up for sale, or this has come up for sale. We're like, Dan, we cannot buy something this big in 1 hour, and it passes you by. And it's about really knowing what opportunity is right for you, and at some point you're right, you do have to, it is a risk, you have to kind of grit your teeth and say, yeah, screw it, you're just going to do it, because you can't set out everything perfectly. There is a risk to everything you do, and at some point you need to commit to it and just give it your effort and give it your all.
It's quite a shift mentally from being an athlete where all of the risk is on the rider. Like, it's a very personal risk, you know, in terms of a business model. It's quite nice, you know, sponsors pay into the race team, and the risk is on the athlete more than on the business. So suddenly shifting from that mentality, which is probably quite blasé at times, you know, you become very risk averse. You know, you're not too worried if you get injured, other than the fact that it's going to hurt. To that kind of business mentality where there's 15 years ramifications for this decision. So it's a huge, it's a huge commitment.
That was literally going to be my next question, which is brilliant. I was going to say, like, what's your attitude to risk being like from athlete to business? So it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see it from your point of view, where you're...
Yeah, what's your risk capability?
You're in the business side of it rather than the risks of an athlete side of it, really.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that, really.
I actually think that athletes make terrible business people.
Yeah, it's
like
terrible.
If I'm honest, you know, your appetite for risk is so high as an athlete, and you know, you just become, it's just embedded in you for like 20 years, you know, where if you don't take those risks, you're not going to succeed.
Yeah, because no point have I ever been really that worried about any of it, because you're not going to die. So
it's always that attitude, isn't it? If it isn't going to kill me, then I'll try it.
Whereas you're like, this could happen, this could happen.
Yeah, and it's always it's never like...
Live in a tent.
It's always a calculated risk, you know, from the moment you wake up. You know, as an athlete, from the moment you wake up, you're just calculating.
But I think business is the same, though, isn't it? It's all calculated risk, and it's...
Yeah, and you could argue that we've been really calculated, because it's taken us over 20 years to commit to anything other than racing. To it, when you're going to set out on these paths and take risks, it's important to have a solid team around you and to build a team that does work well together and that does have different expertise. You know, like I was saying earlier, like Dan's the business side, you probably couldn't win a World Cup.
Probably.
I've tried to diversify into the business and other roles, but you've got to be honest, I can race World Cups, and that's where my, that's what I'm good at. And Dan's spent the last 15 years becoming...
I can't do either.
No, that's... You're like the Pied Piper of mountain biking.
No, I mean, the team thing's a huge thing we should touch on, because, you know, we learnt it from racing. You know, downhill mountain biking is an individual sport which has got a huge bearing on the whole team behind the athlete, whether that's, you know, a cook at the race, or whether it's a sports psychologist, the team manager, the mechanics, you know, the physio. God, you could go on and on. Yeah. PR, you know, we've got, you know, Jill's doing a great job on the PR side of things and communications, and it's just a massive team that goes into it, and that is the same obviously in business. And we're quite lucky that we've got a cool business in terms of, you know, the people that we employ all like mountain biking. They love mountain biking.
Yeah.
And we're doing collectively this amazing project together, and everyone is as a much important person as the next person. And being based here in Mahuncliffe was another of those key
kind
of decision moments that you were talking about before. Yeah. It was a huge risk. Can we convince people to move to Mid Wales?
It's in the middle of nowhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really?
With no Starbucks.
Yeah, and it was a real question, wasn't it?
Like, we looked at
we did look at other places, you know, down Bristol Way, like near where the sort of machine, the printer machine comes from, and you know, more in the Midlands where Brownie comes from, and it's about... You were very certain that because it's a small startup, but the people that work in the business, you're giving them their lifestyle as well. You're not just giving them a job. You're giving them that opportunity to live the dream, you know, riding bikes, living in the mountains, having a good job. It's the dream, really, but it is a risk for the business. So...
Yeah, and
it's about believing in it.
We're lucky people believed in it and have taken that risk. You know, we've had people move from Scotland, from Leeds, from all over South Wales, and and hopefully they're enjoying it still.
But is the business where you wanted it to be from the original vision? There's a lot of size.
Well, we've been through COVID, so that wasn't particularly helpful.
No.
You know, we put the business plan together pre-COVID. And that certainly slowed us down. But in terms of the racing element. Did we think we'd have a world champion on a bike by this point without an Afton as their surname? Yeah. No way.
Right.
And we're very lucky to be, the race team's very lucky to be where it is with the support of Continental Tyres as well. That's a huge kind of factor in all of this, is their support to us as a team. Yeah. And I guess as the business, we're at that point now where traction's good and it's starting to move forward, but it's taken some real grunt.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a startup, 4 or 5 years is nothing, is it really, to get to get anywhere. So the business side, but the performance side, like Dan said, is far outweighed what we imagined in these first few years. And having the belief of, because the race team has given us the contacts for the kind of OE partnerships that you need to sell product, to sell the bikes, and we've got that because of the race team. So it is a real kind of collaboration.
And question to you, Rach, from where you were originally as like an 8-year-old kid, are you where you thought you would be back then, or have you way surpassed any expectation you ever had?
I mean, I find it pretty overwhelming to look at the life ahead of this, the year you're in, really. I don't think I've ever had any focus outside of the next 6 months, really, as a racer. And I've always raced, and it's always been about racing. So it was always about, like, this year win, next year win, don't get hurt. And I feel like I'm just still on that path, and thinking that outside of races is pretty terrifying, really. So
6 months, we can't get you to think 1 week ahead.
Yeah. It's a very reactive way to live, and it's hard in some ways, because now you come to the end of your career and you do have to start thinking further ahead. And I don't know. Yeah, I guess I'm there.
and what, the vision's obviously changed, like you mentioned COVID as well, kind of having to reset the goalposts almost some part of the way. But what is the vision now? You kind of alluded to a few bits before with, like, you know, growing and scaling and the new prototype you've got, but what would you say the vision looks like now?
I mean, for me, for the bike park, the vision's quite clear. You know, it's an easier thing to scale, you know, in terms of the natural growth of it and expanding onto into other forests and kind of growing that way. But yeah, for the bike company, I think, I mean, Dan will be able to talk more about this, but probably being able to have other kind of manufacturing facilities in different continents, I think, is probably ultimately the way the business needs to go. So we're manufacturing locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that close to market manufacturing model is definitely central to what our kind of plans for the brand are. But yeah, short term, it's realising a product at a kind of mid-range price point, so that we can ultimately give access to the Afton brand to more people. Mm-hmm. The new product we've got coming up is going to hit quite a sweet spot in terms of its price point. So it's a more volume-based product, but also one that we can really stand behind and be proud of as well. So yeah, that's the big milestone that we're looking at next.
And in general, what have been the biggest takeaways from each of your journeys that you'd share with others?
Don't go into business with your family. Terrible idea.
Number one.
Number two?
Don't go into business with your family. Don't. And if you do, just don't ever see each other. No, that's not true. It's been a great idea.
I don't know, it's kind of, I guess for me, it's kind of, there's always, you can always give more than you think you can.
Oh, God.
Which is a good bloody job with these two. No, you can always go further than you think. And I guess it's the same when you train as an athlete, I guess. You can always go harder, you can always do more, and you always surprise yourself when you think you're at the end and you can do more. The resilience that you build up in business year on year and after setback. And the thing I always tell myself is that this is where others give up.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's for me is the kind of what I tell myself when I need a little pep talk. It's kind of it's kind of that.
Dan Brown.
There's a lot of people. Jill here as well. You know.
Yeah, like this. Well, Dan and Jill have been there from for the last. Like Jill came to work with us when her daughter was like one year, which is mad. But Jill and Dan have like believed in it. all the time, you know, from day one, probably more than maybe we did. And that's, they're the kind of people that you couldn't possibly do it without.
There's like, so many people, you know, Lloydie on the race team, you know, he joined us for a good number of years and has been driving that forward. I mean, we're, you know, the designers,
true, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You could list, you know, right. 50 different names, really.
Okay.
And like none of it would have even started without Dan as a mad kid with ADHD, probably now would be labelled with that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, mum is just, you know, she should be here. Like,
yeah,
he was just different, you know? Like, got kicked out of all the nurseries, got kicked out of, like, play groups for just... He had too much energy, and she couldn't channel that energy. And when he got to an age where he could do something with it, and, like, he doesn't like talking about it, but he is, like, a... He kind of draws people to mountain biking that are a bit lost in life. You know, there's so many kids over the years that have grown up with him, and people that struggle in those kind of societal, like, norms, like school and those areas where you don't fit in. You just feel like you don't. No, but you've helped so many people that don't fit into that kind of traditional way of going through life, and you know, you didn't really at school. It's so inspiring to have someone. You know, and lots of successful people are like that, you know, dyslexic or all these things that in school are seen as bad things, but they're actually like amazing things for dedicating your life to something and succeeding. And I think it's so inspiring, so no one really talks about.
Yeah, I think, like, if you can find a focus for it, that's the key, you know, and some people find it and some people don't.
A single-minded drive to to do something is incredible.
Yeah, I think coming back to your question before about what would you take from it all, I think just not being afraid to commit everything. And I think we learned that from racing, you know, every athlete will say that. But when it comes to business, I think it's terrifying. But if you're going to be successful, you do have to literally commit everything you have. You know, you're remortgaging your houses, you're all in, you know, so it can't fail. Because there's a lot of competition out there and there's a lot of talented people, and they're going to, you know, if you don't go all the way, they're going to.
Yeah, so. And I feel like, because we've had an interview like that with someone to work with, and he wasn't willing to take those risks, you know, and we were just like, you've got to be willing to put it all on the line. And
it's terrifying, like, and it's, it can go... You know, two ways, but if you're not all in, then
I guess it is only going to go two ways.
Yeah, But I feel like I've always thought, like, having a plan B is a terrible idea, because, like Dan said, when it comes to that extra 1% where you're like, I've got to do it, you know, you've got a fallback plan and you're safe, and that's I feel like that's a terrible idea, because you need to have that 100% like commitment to it. Like, and I always do this. But the Eminem song, like, success is the only option, because failure, like, he was in the ghetto, like, he was in that caravan, and he wanted to get out, and the only way he could get out was to make something of himself.
8 Mile, wasn't it?
And so many people like that, so many athletes and singers, successful people, they've come from, like, the gnarliest places, and they just wanted, like, out, and the only way is to succeed, and it's like, and you can keep doing that in life, even when you have succeeded, by taking on more risk. So you take a massive mortgage to buy a mountain. Well, that's, you've got to make it work. So you need to pay off that mortgage.
There is no plan B.
Yeah, exactly.
It's working.
And like, you take those risks and you have to make it work. And yeah, I feel like that's a really good or terrible way to push yourself.
Depends just really look at it.
And last question. For those who need help to get from where they are in whatever situation they're currently in to get to where they want to be in life, any advice from each of you?
I feel like a lot of people, you know, like, you wouldn't, like, we say this, you take risks, like, it's really good to take risks, push yourself, but you've got to be realistic. Like, you wouldn't just, you know, tomorrow I wouldn't just say, I'm going to start a Thai restaurant because I've got no experience in Taiwanese food. Like, you say, you've got to practice to perfect, and you don't take a stupid risk, an uncalculated risk, you know.
Yep.
You're starting a bike park. We've had 20 years experience of building track, you know. So it's got to be a risk that you have, it's calculated and you do have experience in. Yeah, you can do anything, you really can, but it's got to be, you've got to sort of have experience in that, else it's stupid.
Yeah, and that's something I took away from working with Richard Branson for 20 years, was that everyone always thinks, God, everything was such massive risk, and it was like everything was calculated.
Yeah,
every
exactly.
single
yeah.
risk was calculated, whether it was bringing out a competitor to Coca-Cola and Pepsi,
yeah.
or whether it was having a pop-up BA
and taking
a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You want to start a pizza restaurant, fine, but you need to work in a pizza, like, work, you know, build that knowledge and that skill set before you take that leap.
And I think you build risks, you know. He won't have started by taking a huge risk, you know.
Yeah.
He's built up from the start with a record company and, you know, taking risks, small risks, bigger. And you get...
It's all relative, isn't it?
You get good at calculating risk, and you get good at dealing with risk, and you get good at risk management and managing people, getting people to buy into that risk and take, you know, their own risk in their own lives to help you on your way.
Mm.
And... Yeah, slowly.
Yeah, and
build
I think one of the things you've always said is like, do what you're good at, which I guess is the same as, like, not taking a stupid risk. Like, you do what you're good at, and you get other people to help with the things you're not so good at, rather than trying to do it all yourself. Like, I've always struggled a bit with that. Like, oh, I can do the social media for this company, I can do this. And Dan's like, you can't do everything, you know.
No.
Do what you're good at. And
I think you can do everything if you only want it to grow to a certain size, but at a certain size, it becomes micromanaging, you know. And other people out there are better at it than you, you know. You're good at one thing, and it's so easy. You see so many times where a business becomes successful, and the person that started that business stops doing what they were good at and moves into another area of the business, and it just doesn't work, you know. Stick to what you're good at and get people in who are experts in their area.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
thanks for having us.
Dan, Rach, Brownie.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Bikes, thank you very much.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video, as this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be. All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, then screw it and just do it. Until next time.